I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we were supposed to have part two of our interview with Jerry Branum, where we were talking about the year 1980. And last week, we talked about the 1980 Mr. Olympia that took up the whole show. So on today's broadcast, we were supposed to have the second part of that interview where Jerry and I were going to talk about the other contests from 1980, including the 1980 Mr. America, the 1980 Mr. Universe, and some of the Grand Prix shows, including the Night of the Champions. So I have delayed that show for another week because I did want to do a tribute to Peter McGough, who passed away on, I believe it was December 30th of last year. And I was looking back over the archives of all the shows I've done over the last 3.5 years. And it looks like I interviewed Peter a total of like 5 times on this podcast. So I thought I would take some clips of some of the shows that we did, some of the interviews we did with Peter, and just play them back and give him sort of a tribute to his life and to all the things that he was passionate about, which of course was bodybuilding and writing. And I did see a muscular development. .com did a sort of a tribute to Peter this last week, and they were interviewing some of the bodybuilders that knew him, including Dorian Yates, of course, who was a good friend of his, and Kevin Livroni and Chris Cormier. And that was good, but I thought it would be better to even hear just from Peter himself, from his words. And I think you guys are really going to love the show. So we will get to that in a minute. Before we get to that, though, I do want to mention our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation, plus they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right. And at the end of our podcast, after we hear from Peter, from all these clips that I have set up for you guys, I am going to read another article from an old Iron Man magazine. And this was from 1980. So it kind of ties in with our review of 1980. And this one is about the Night of the Champions from 1980 that Chris Dickerson won. He beat out Robbie Robinson, who was the winner of that contest for the last 2 years. Our friend Pat Comer sent these to me from an old Iron Man magazine. So I'm going to read that article as soon as this tribute to Peter McGough ends. All right. And I also do want to mention my John Hansen Fitness Challenge, which was supposed to start today, January 11th, but I've decided to extend it one more week. So all the guys that are starting already today, they will have an additional week. They'll have 13 weeks, but the contest actually is going to start on January 18th and go all the way up until April 12th. So that will be the 12 weeks. So if you haven't entered yet, and you still want to enter, you've got one more week to enter the second annual John Hansen Fitness Challenge. And if you're on my YouTube page, you want to check out this video I just did with Nick Rizzitello. Nick was the winner of the Fall Fitness Challenge, which I had last fall from September till the end of the year in December. And Nick made amazing progress. He was in first place, and he was very, very excited. You're going to see in this interview, he's very pumped up. He was really excited about entering, and he made unbelievable transformation in his physique. He lost so much fat, and he actually added muscle to his body as he was losing the weight, because you can see in the measurements that we go over in the interview, he actually put muscle on his chest, his legs. I think his arms got bigger. So it's an unbelievable transformation. And then Nick explains in the interview that he was actually overcoming PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, from his previous job as a police officer. He got into an accident that he explains in the interview. And he was really suffering from this for at least a couple of years, like the last 3 or 4 years. Nick found that being on this transformation program, following a regimented workout and diet, he was actually able to control it a lot more. And it was a really interesting interview. So check that out on my YouTube channel. I've also got a lot of contest clips from that 1985 WABA Pro World that Samir Banoot won. So those have been getting a lot of hits. I think one of them got 75,000 views. So a lot of people are checking that out. Loving the way that the bodybuilders used to look from the 1980s, of course. So if you want to enter the John Hansen Fitness Challenge, just go to johnhansenfitness.com. It's right there on the opening page. And as I said, we will start this officially on January 18th. So you have one more week to sign up. And once you register for the John Hansen Fitness Challenge, you'll get a personalized workout and diet program to change your body, whatever your goals are. We have some people who are trying to get bigger and add more muscle. Of course, a lot of people want to lose fat and get more ripped. But whatever your goals are, whoever makes the biggest transformation in their physique, whether it's losing fat or gaining muscle, the top three competitors or the top three people who sign up for the program who make the most progress will win prizes. They will win free DVDs and free books from me, and they will also win free supplements from Old School Labs. So you will get that personalized workout and diet program, and you will also get 12 weeks of coaching from me where I will check in with you every week, and I will make sure that you're making progress. And if you're not making progress, I will change around your workout routine, or I will change around your diet just to make sure that you're making progress. That's the biggest asset to the program, is that I will keep you guys accountable every week, because anyone who's followed a diet before knows that staying on the program every week is the hardest part. So I will keep you accountable for all 12 weeks, and that will really be responsible for you making some great, great progress. So like I said, go to johnhansenfitness.com and sign up, and you will get in great shape this year and start the new year off right. All right, and as I said, at the end of our tribute to Peter McGough, I will be reading this article from the 1980 issue of Iron Man magazine, where they talk about the 1980 Night of the Champions. All right, here's our tribute to the great Peter McGough. Here we go. All right, this first clip with Peter, this was our first interview we did on the podcast. It was from December 27th, 2017. And this, I think, was season 4, where we talked about the 1990 Mr. Olympia contest, which was the only Mr. Olympia contest that was drug tested. And Peter wrote about the contest for Flex magazine. In fact, Peter told me off the air that he actually wrote an article of 10,000 words, which is a huge, huge article, because there was just so much going on surrounding the 1980 Mr. Olympia. So in this part of the interview, Peter talks about how he started in bodybuilding and the magazine that he published in England, which was called Pumping Press. And he also talks about his experience going to the 1971 NABBA Mr. Universe, where he got to see Sergio Oliva. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And I have a very special guest, my good friend, Peter McGough. And Peter, as I'm sure most of you know, was one of the leaders of the magazine scene. He started his own magazine in England, and then Joe Weider discovered his talents and brought him over to America. And then he spent many years working for the Joe Weider organization, and he also worked a little bit for Robert Kennedy. And of course, today we're talking about the 1990 Mr. Olympia, and Peter was at that show, so I wanted to get his thoughts. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Thanks for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. How are you doing, Peter? I know you've been going through some health issues a little bit lately, and you know many of us are really concerned about you, and we're always thinking about you. Those in the bodybuilding community, I think we all respect you and appreciate you, and I consider you a good friend of mine. So how are you doing lately?
Well, it was a very rough summer. A couple of crises popped up where it looked quite serious, but I've seemed to have stabilized a bit. You know, I've been dealing with cancer now for over 4 years, so
yeah.
I'm feeling pretty good now. I got a good result a couple of weeks ago, so
good.
And I really do appreciate the support I'm getting from the community, but at the moment I'm fine.
Oh, great. That's great to hear.
Yeah, I think a lot of these younger people, they don't really know what's, you know, anything about the past and everything. So that's why I think it's great that so many people are reaching out to you, and they still know who you are. They respect you, and they know that the value you had in our community, you know, with your writing. And I think it's great that people still look up to you, you know, and respect you. A lot of us older guys, we don't get respected, right, Peter?
Sounds like my press agent, John. Thanks for all the praise. I'll leave that up to you. Yeah, I love bodybuilding. I love being in it. I love reporting on it. And in many ways, the 1990 Olympia was maybe the most interesting Olympia I've ever attended because of all the peripheral stuff that was going on.
Yeah, let's get into that in a minute. But tell us a little bit, for those listeners that don't know you, Peter, tell us a little bit about your background. I know you're from England, and you got into bodybuilding at a pretty young age, right?
Yeah, I was 20 when I went into the gym for the first time, okay. 1969, August. I remember it, you know, as soon as I got the pump, I was sold on it, you know, and the gym I worked in, you know, people, they were ramshackle gyms in those days. There was no Total Fitness and all that business.
Yeah.
I can go back to that first workout, close my eyes, and relive it, and I can smell the gym. What you smelt in the gym was sweat and milk, because that was our pre-workout supplement at the time. Got into writing about bodybuilding about 10 years later, started my own magazine with my wife, Anne, which were Pumping Press. Joe Weider then made us an offer to go to California. We thought we were going for a couple of years. And 25 years later, I'm still in the States. Became editor-in-chief of Flex and Muscle and Fitness hers, and retired from the company in 2009. And I've been doing freelance stuff ever since, just to keep my mind active.
Tell us a little bit about that magazine, Pumping Press, that you did. How was that experience? I know I read stories about Robert Kennedy talking about when he started Muscle Mag International. And, of course, Joe Weider, you know, started his magazine way back in the day. So that had to be kind of an exciting but nerve-wracking experience, starting your own magazine.
Yeah, what happened was I'd worked for British magazines, and they did very well in the 80s, but then sort of mid-80s, 85, Flex brought out a UK edition, Muscle Mag did as well, and of course the British couldn't compete with 8-page spreads of Bob Paris and all the rest of it. So yeah. I had an idea that, you know, what was missing from the magazines was topical news, gossip, controversy. They tended to be a bit squeaky clean, you know, Flex. And we produced a bodybuilding tabloid. Now, what that did, that maximized on the gossip. But the great thing was it almost, I say it preceded the internet, because in those days, you'd go to a contest in May, and then you wouldn't read about it in the magazines for a couple of months. You never saw anything. There was no iPhones and emails flying about, you know, showing photographs. But we, with the tabloid, we were able to, say, report the Mr. Olympia, for instance, the 1991 Mr. Olympia, on the Saturday it took place, and the following, 10 days later, it was on the shelves, on the newsagents, and people couldn't believe it. When the 1991 Olympians came to the post-European tour, and we handed out the magazine with the full report, photographs and everything, they just couldn't believe how quickly it was. And it was quite a pugnacious magazine, you know. It was during the time of the WBF, World Bodybuilding Federation, through. And, you know, eventually caught Joe Weider. Ben Weider actually was the one who approached me first. I knew Ben better than Joe at that point. And here we are.
Yeah, that's great you say that, because, of course, you know, everything's different now with the internet. And you're right. I remember when I would read the magazines as a kid, the first thing I would go to, or the thing that I found most interesting, was the gossip. You know, I wanted to know who was training, you know, for what contest, or who was dating who, or what was going on, you know. So that was the most interesting part of any magazine, whether it was Muscle Mag or Weider's magazine or anybody. I remember you told me a story that one of the guys who really freaked you out was Sergio Oliva at the 1971 Mr. Universe, one in London, England, the professional Mr. Universe that Bill Pearl won. So I was wondering if you could relate that story to us.
Well, you know, in those days, we used to go down to the NABBA Universe every year from our gym. We were a busload of us. And it was our... You've got to remember, in those days, you only had magazines. There was no videos. You never saw these guys move unless you saw them on stage. Mm-hmm. You know, that you saw the statues move. So I'd been down the previous year seeing Arnold. He didn't enter in 71. Sergio was in, Bill Pearl was in, and Reg Park. And I'd seen all the photos of Sergio, you know, those massive round muscle bellies, a small bone structure.
Yeah.
But I just wasn't prepared for when he walked out. I just went back in my seat. And I've never really had that reaction since, you know. And it's just like he was second, but to me, he caught my eye, caught my imagination. And, you know, in those days, the competition wasn't like it is now. Dog eat dog, as it were, or whatever. We went down there for a celebration to see our stars. Oh, here's Frank Zane, here's Franco Colombo, here's, yeah, you know, Chris Dickerson later on. You saw all these guys, Arnold, saw them move. So it was a once-in-a-year event that we just used to celebrate.
Yeah, I don't think today's generation can understand that, but you're right. I mean, we only saw them in the magazine. We only saw pictures. We never heard them talk. We never saw them move. And to see them in person was like seeing a movie star or a rock star, you know, because it was like, it was so magical for us. I think that's why it was like the magical era.
Yeah, but it was absolutely, it was a special time, you know, that we'll never, I could go on about, you know, the pros and cons of the way things are presented now. Some things are better, some things are not so good, but, you know, you're in your 20s, you're living the life. It was a great time, you know. Then we'd all rush back and start to emulate them, get in the gym the next morning, and you know, the place was packed.
Yeah, and the crowds were a lot louder too, right? I mean, I remember going to the Olympia in the late 70s, and the crowds were crazy.
Yeah, they used to go nuts when the guys, because, you know, you never saw them once a year. And the other thing that if you look at photos of that time, especially the 70s, everybody's dressed up to watch. There was none of this ragged T-shirts, and, you know, it was an event. It was an evening out, an afternoon out.
Yeah,
especially you would wear a suit and a tie, and you know, it really added to the whole atmosphere.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to see Arnold too then, the year before in 1970.
Yeah. When you know, he beat Reg Park, and I think Dave Draper was third. You know, Draper was in many ways he was my favorite bodybuilder. He was the one that, when I started reading the magazines in the early 60s, he was the one that caught my imagination.
Yeah, a lot of people love Draper because he was featured a lot in Weider's magazine on the beach.
Yeah, it was the surf boy look, Californian, even though he came from New Jersey. And, in those days, it was like another, you know, nobody from England went to America in those days unless you were a Hollywood film star. There was never any dreams of actually ending up in California. And to think that I did end up talking to Dave and all these guys is just, I've had such a blessed life in that way. At that age, 20, I'd never imagined that I'd have the life and the career I've had.
Yeah. You just mentioned that, I saw on Facebook, you said you think the best writer in bodybuilding is Dave Draper.
Yeah. He writes from the soul. He really gives you everything. And it's difficult to really open your soul and not embarrass yourself. Dave does that. Dave, he's still the same as he was back then. He was never in this for money or fame or glory. And even though he's got books out and got a business, you can still tell he's doing it because he loves what he's doing. He's not doing it to earn an extra buck. And he's a very genuine, humble guy. I just love aspects of him.
All right, now in this clip, this was from March 27, 2018, when Wayne Galash from Australia and we traveled over to Peter's home in Fort Myers, I believe is where he lived. And we got to spend a really great afternoon with Peter, and Wayne actually just contacted me after he heard about Peter's passing. And he said he was really felt fortunate that he and I got to do that a couple of years ago and spend some time with Peter, because we got to spend the whole afternoon with him talking about bodybuilding, and then we all went out to lunch afterwards with his wife, Anne. So it was a really great afternoon. And now that Peter has passed away, Wayne was very grateful that we got a chance to do that.
Wayne doesn't get to travel to America very often. He usually just comes in every fall for the Mr. Olympia contest in Vegas. And he actually missed the contest this last year because of the coronavirus. He was not able to travel. So Wayne was very, very grateful that we got to spend that day with Peter. So in this part of the interview, I talked to both Wayne and Peter about their experiences of going to the NABBA Universe. And they were both at the 1970 Mr. Universe in London that Arnold won his last NABBA Universe. And we also talk a little bit about Arnold winning the 1980 Mr. Olympia.
All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And I'm here with two of my good friends who are very big historians in the sport. We have Wayne Galash from Australia. And Wayne has filmed videos and movies of many of the classic competitions going back to 1970 and videotapes of great bodybuilders guest posing and doing posing exhibitions. And then we have my other friend, Peter McGuff. And Peter, of course, has written for Joe Weider's magazine and Muscle Mag International. And he's a big historian of the sport as well. And one of two great historians here talking about the bodybuilding shows. So guys, we were talking, Wayne, about the NABBA Universe, and we did a whole series about this on our podcast. So you guys were both at the 1970 Mr. Universe and NABBA, the NABBA Universe, which was Arnold's last NABBA Universe. And you didn't know each other at the time, though, right?
No, we didn't. We were, as I said, we were moving in a parallel manner, but we didn't know each other then, and we got to know each other at a later date, probably about the time when Peter went into publishing.
Yeah, I was there as a pure fan, but I mean, it's I think I knew who Wayne was at that time. He wouldn't have known me, but it's funny. Neither of us can remember when we first met. We just know it's 20 or 30 years ago, and really, in all that time, we've never sat down like this and had a chat. We've all been scurrying about working and doing stuff.
We always said hello and said a few words, but we've never really had stopped to have a proper chat.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, and you only get to be called a historian when you get to a certain age. That's why nobody calls a 25-year-old a historian. You've got to have grey hair and all the rest of it before you get there.
That's true.
So let's talk about that 1970 NABBA Universe. I think this is a, you know, it's always one of my favorite contests looking back over the years. I think that was Arnold's great, he was in unbelievable shape at that contest. That was his last appearance in the NABBA Universe. So, Peter, how many NABBA Universes had you seen up until that point? Was that your first one?
That was the very first one I went to, because I'd only got into working out in the year before, August 1969. I was 20 then.
Okay.
So,
but you knew of these guys like Dave Draper and Arnold and Reg Park.
I was always looking at the, I wasn't buying the magazines in those days, but I was always looking at them in the news agents, so I knew who these guys were. And then our gym, Stewart's gym in Nottingham, we used to go down to the Universe every year on a bus, you know, and it was a celebration of what we did.
Yeah, we were just talking off camera about how, you know, there was no internet, obviously, then. And so when you got to see these shows, it was the first time you ever saw these guys in person and moving. You know, like you said, the statues came to life. I thought that was perfect how you said that. And it's really amazing. And, like, you guys took a bus, and it was like a party going there.
Yeah, I mean, there was one occasion where, it's a long story, but I don't know whether to tell it. No, I'll tell it another time. Yeah, we'd come back, and it was like, remember when you were a kid, and you went to the Saturday morning pictures, and you'd come out, you'd be Roy Rogers. So when you come back from the Universe, I'm Frank Zane. Oh, that's awesome. I'm Elias Petsas, you know. And people start posing and doing all sorts of crazy stuff. It was like, it set us up for the following year. You know, it was a great day out, such fun.
And Wayne, now, how long have you been into following bodybuilding at that point?
I had been a bodybuilding fan since 1962, and I started training when I was 20. And so I competed up until 1968, and then I was also doing camera work, which I started in 1966. So 4 years before I did my first international contest, which was the 70 Universe, I'd been filming the top bodybuilders in Australia, and the best one I had seen there was Frank Colombira.
Yeah.
And he was unbeatable in the period that he was at his peak. And after Frank Colombiero, which was early 1970, I worked with him, I thought, I've got to get over for Arnold's last universe, because it was a well-known fact that it was probably his last. And then I took my camera overseas to the universe, and then I've just kept going every year since with overseas capturing of bodybuilding history.
Why did you think it was going to be the Arnold's last
year? Well, I think I'd read it in the magazines that it was probably his last, and I knew that there would be pressure between WIDA and NABBA, and that he would probably go in the IFBB direction with Joe. So it was a general consensus that it would probably be his last for various reasons, and I think the magazines might have said it or hinted at it, and I was aware that that was my last chance probably to see him, and that turned out to be the way it was.
Okay.
Peter, did you go to the pre-judging also, or just a night show?
Well, it was an afternoon show, wasn't it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was Queen Victoria Theatre.
Yes, I think I said to John, I think it started at about 2 o'clock and finished about 4:30.
That's it. And then we used to go. It wasn't a banquet, but it was a get together with the guys, and you'd get the likes of Frank Zane whipping his top off and doing poses.
Yeah.
It was that year, 1971. It was. I got two friends, John Courtney, who got me into bodybuilding and who died recently, lifelong best friend I ever had, and another friend we had, Les Wright. He was Commission of the Junior Mr. Britain in the 50s. Yeah. These were both great talkers, wits. Les attached himself to Oscar Heidenstam as we approached the banquet, and we walked in with Oscar. We didn't have to pay because everybody thought we were with Oscar. I can tell you another story about Les Wright maybe a bit later on, but to go to 1970, you know, Dave Draper was in it, Reg Park. This was the big meeting. You know, Reg had been like Arnold's mentor, and this was the mentor taking on the pupil. Yeah. And, you know, somebody said something to Arnold about, so how's the contest going? And he said, what contest? Which was typical Arnold, even arrogant towards this legend, you know. Yeah. Of course he won. But the interesting thing there is, the Mr. World was being held the next day in Columbus.
Yes,
right.
And that's when he first met Jim Lorimer. Jim Lorimer arranged to fly Arnold and a couple of the other guys from the NABBA universe in London on the Saturday to Sunday in Columbus. And, of course, that's the first time Arnold beat Sergio. So it was a momentous weekend. It was almost, if you look about it, that was his goodbye to NABBA.
It was.
And this was, I've arrived in the IFBB, I just beat Sergio, and in a few weeks' time I'm going to be Mr. Olympia.
Right.
You know, so it was a real fulcrum moment.
Yeah.
And what people forget is the fact that because it was an afternoon contest in England, he was able to rush to Heathrow Airport, fly to New York, and then I understand Jim Lorimer had a private jet to rush him to Columbus.
That is correct. They couldn't get a scheduled flight from New York to Columbus, but the private jet, which shows how big thinking Jim Lorimer was all the time.
Yes, that story came out last weekend at the Arnold Classic when they had the Sunday seminar.
Yeah.
And I interviewed Boyer Cohen, and I remember he said that they didn't have to go through customs or nothing. They just went on this private jet. Yeah. So Lorimer must have had some, because he used to work for the FBI, so he must have had some connections. Right, right.
But I'd like to ask you two, what did you think of the result between Reg Park and Dave Draper? Do you think that Dave Draper was unlucky to get third?
Well, Dave Draper, I mean, I'm English, so Reg Park was an inspirational legend to us all. But I, early 60s, I really got involved with bodybuilding a lot earlier than the first time I went to the gym. I remember looking at, I was in the Scouts. I went to this Scout Hall. In this little anteroom, they had a few weights, had some magazines. And, you know, the guys that were in the magazine then for Joe were Hugo Larbra, Freddie Ortiz.
Yeah, I remember that.
Now, Freddie Ortiz, if he came out today and you showed a photograph, people would say, that's Photoshop. Nobody can look. Nobody has arms or lats like that.
They were real.
They were real, yeah. So, and I was a bit of an artist, a drawing artist, and I used to
draw Superman, but I used to make him more muscular than the actual Superman. Yeah. So I was aware of the Weeder magazines because the soup, you know, the adverts were in the back of the Superman comic. I'm rambling here, but I had this sort of slow burn. I knew who the bodybuilders were even before I made the commitment to start training, you know, because my friend John, he was always trying to get me into training. I said, no, my game's soccer and track. I'll get muscle bound, you know, stupid theory. But of course, once I did start to train, I was always I had the most stamina on a soccer field and could run for it anyway. So what was the point I was trying to make, John? You know,
Dave Draper.
Yeah, I would have. Dave was more. What's the word? Cut, you know, conditioned.
He had better condition for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Word condition.
But, you know, like I say, you know, it wasn't. We never used to argue and scream about results, you know. It was more, you know, you were there to see the guys. But I would have maybe given it to Dave second place. But
I would have too. Yeah. I thought he had just a little bit more condition on the day, and I felt that in a close decision, Reg being such an idol of the English, that helped pull him through into second place.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the way it works out. But Arnold was on his own, wasn't he?
We're fortunate. We saw Arnold compete at his peak, and there's not many people around that are talking in microphones today that actually saw him at his peak. Well, he had it. He had the height. He had fantastic condition. He had very good overall symmetry for a tall man, wonderful biceps, and a fantastic twisting back shot, which many people have tried to copy, but you never see his twisting back pose on bodybuilders today. And that's the difference. They can't do it.
Right.
No. I mean, he didn't have the narrowest of waists, but he could make that in those three-quarter shots. He looked like he had a 22-inch waist.
Yeah.
The thing about Arnold is he always played to his best shots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if he was asked to do a double bicep or he'd throw it a side chest before it, just, no, that's how good I am.
Yeah.
It was always the showman.
And he was smart.
Yeah, he had a strategy on stage. It was, you know, it always looked easy to him, big beaming smile, the other guy's sweating and, traumatized, and he's just having fun. But that was his strategy.
Yeah.
That's what I always heard about Arnold. He was always aware of not only how he looked, but he always was aware of what was going on around him, where everyone else was more concerned with what was going on with them during a contest.
And Arnold also knew how to psych out his opponents. He had them thinking they were beaten right from the start, and he was always acting like the winner, which he knew he was going to be.
Right.
And he did that for many, many years, and that's in part how he won the 1980 Olympia, because he somewhat psyched the others out. And he had a pretty good overall package, and we've talked about this many times. Chris Dickerson, who plays second, if you were a judge then, when it came down to the last two, Arnold or Chris Dickerson, I think you can understand, whatever the politics were involved, you can understand they said, well, we prefer Arnold to Chris Dickerson as Mr. Olympia. So I think that was part of the psychology and what actually happened in 1980.
Yeah.
All right, in this clip, and this is a continuation of our interview with Peter McGough and Wayne Galash, we talk about how the magazines have now faded away and about how important that was for the industry back in the day. Here we go.
So let's talk a little bit about the magazines, Peter. We're just looking at some of your old pumping press here, and Flex Magazine just announced that they're going to stop publication. You were the head of that magazine for a long time. And one thing I noticed looking at your pumping press was the amount of material, the amount of words. And you were just saying, we just had a conversation before, and you were saying, you know, when the 91 Olympia came out, you had that magazine, you had pumping press ready the next week for a report on the 91 Olympia. And you said you wrote like 30,000 words, which is amazing, because you wrote all the material in that magazine. And I never realized pumping press had so much material. So I remember growing up, you know, reading the magazines in the late 70s, and I loved reading the magazines. They only came out once a month, and you'd read them, and you'd reread them, and reread them, and that's how, you know, I got to know these guys. You got to know their personalities. You got to know their background. I remember I sort of learned a lot of geography, because if some guy said he was born in a city in Maryland, I remembered that city from reading the magazines, you know.
Right.
So we got so much information, and now, like you said, it's all different. The magazines are all dying. Dave Palumbo and John Romano just did a show on RX Muscle, and they were talking about how things are changing now with the media. The magazines are dead. And it really is a shame, isn't it? Because we don't get all that information. We don't get a good sense of the contest anymore. All we're getting is snippets. We're getting the information. And I noticed, like, with the Olympia or the Arnold now, even though it's covered in the internet, you know, and they might even have a live broadcast, the next day it's like it's over. It's done. And back then, when we used to read about it, it would last for months. We would talk about it for all year, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's like I said earlier on, you know, I didn't know Arnold was entering the 1980 Mr. Olympia until I saw the magazine, which was 2 months after the event. And I always go back to when Big Ramy came into the 2013 New York Pro, he was an instant star. Globally, everybody saw him. Mm-hmm. By Wednesday, it was dead news. Mm-hmm. In the old days, nobody would have even seen him until a few weeks later.
Right.
And then the commotion would have started. Yeah. And I always looked upon it's a bit like modern television to me. I felt because we were all waiting for the magazines at the same time, mm-hmm. we had a communal experience.
Yeah.
We all had the same experience. We're reading this. Mm. This is the story of the 1994 Olympia. Whereas now you've got one story over here, a bit over there, a bit over. So you got the whole package, and now you don't get that. But it's not, I mean, it's very, very sad that print's gone the way it is, but it's not just bodybuilding. I mean, even the New York Times saying in a few years it's done. And the other side of it is we're now dealing with an upcoming generation of teenagers and 20-somethings who have got used to the internet. That's where they go for their information. They don't buy magazines. The attention span is shorter because they're doing all this business on the text and the all the abbreviations are getting on my nerves now. You know,
emojis.
It's like in 20 years' time, people are going to walk in and instead of saying you're all right, they're like, and he's going to go, LOL, you know. So everything's, I'm looking sometimes on the TV, you know, when they started saying President of the United States, POTUS, I was thinking, oops, who's POTUS? Anyway, I'm digressing. But, yeah, it's a culture shift as well. And, you know, I do hope people aren't rejoicing in the recession with magazines going on, because it, you know, they were a golden era, and if you lived through it, it was a great time, and we learnt a lot, you know. And it's, you know, it's a shame it's going that way, but for God's sake, let's revere it and look back on it with some fondness.
Yeah.
Just Arnold the other week, and he had with him a magazine, Peak Magazine, with my report on the 1971. Olympia in Paris, 71 Olympia.
You wrote the report.
I wrote the report. And I had written chapter and verse, like you did, Peter, about what went on. I talked about the amateur contest, which was the Mr. Universe, which Albert Beckles won. And I talked about this unknown bodybuilder who was put up on the stage in the Mr. Olympia, and all this sort of information. And this guy was so happy to have a copy, and he wanted me to see the magazine and do a photograph of me holding the magazine with this report of mine, which I'd forgotten about, which brings me to the point, in-depth journalism about the contest no longer takes place.
Right.
No, it's not looked for anymore either.
Right.
No. I remember reading articles, like one I remember right now is Ed Corney. They did an interview with him, I think it was a 1976 muscle builder, and he talked about training with Arnold for the 1975 Olympia because he was his training partner, and he talked about that experience. And he also talked about how when he started bodybuilding, he was entering these smaller contests, and then he won, I think it was the Universe, the one that was covered in the book Pumping Iron, when he won the 1972 Mr. Universe in Baghdad. And he said that was the seminal point in his career. Like, that changed his career because he became a winner and he knew he could do good things or great things. He could be a great champion with that one win. But he said every bodybuilder goes through that journey, and they always have that one contest where they train like their life depends on it. And then once they win that one contest, it proves to them that they're champions. that was a great insight into the mind of a bodybuilder, into the mind of a champion, and what it takes to win a contest. And you would never get that today on the internet, because nobody's going to interview him. They're just going to say, oh, he won the contest, and that's it. And you might get a little backstage interview on video for a minute or two, but that's it. You're not going to get anything in depth. And that's what I really miss. And me and Wayne were talking in the car over here when we were driving over here, about how you look at old movies like All the President's Men, where they had to research all this stuff and they had to find out all this information. And there's all these, and newspapers used to have researched articles, you know, with all the information. And now if you go to get a news story, it's on the internet and you're only going to get a paragraph and you're just going to get the highlights, you know?
Yeah. And because that's the standard, allied to the fact that people are used now to reading shorter stuff, that's all they want to do. If you said, oh, there's a 5,000-word article here about, oh, I'm never get through with that.
Right.
You know, it's, I used to like to do the pro, I used, like, new guy called, I want to find out what makes this guy tick. Not as, I don't care what he does for his biceps. I want to, you know, like, somebody like Kevin Levrone, who's an interesting character.
Yeah, yeah.
Flex Wheeler, they were all interesting characters. Yeah. I'm not saying there aren't interesting characters today. I mean,
but we never know about it.
Yeah, we've never done the in-depth thing. But you know, when you do the interviews backstage with somebody afterwards, you ask the winner that the winner's head somewhere else. He's thinking this. He's thinking that. He's I want to eat. Get it done. Off he goes. You know, I often feel. I remember Rick Wayne told me. I'm name dropping now. Rick Wayne came back to Weider a few times, as you know, Wayne. But he went back in '75. Oh, no, it must have been before that, maybe. Because Joe was in New York, based in New York, New Jersey. And Joe said, OK, go down Mid-City Gym, come back with a story. So Rick goes down there, comes back, he interviewed all the guys in there. Joe says, no, I don't want to know what they think. I want to know what you think about what was going on.
Mm.
Yeah. Because a journalist is going to give you the goods.
Yeah.
And it's funny. It's a story that reminds me of... Sean Perry. Greg Merritt told me that this guy's got a website and he can write. I got in touch with Sean.
Mm-hmm.
Short story is, I gave him his first assignment was in New York to go to the 25th celebration of Pumping Iron.
New York.
Yeah. And he came back and he said, Gunter was there, Ronnie. He couldn't get to speak to Arnold. I said, Sean, I don't want to know what they think. I want to know what you think. I want to know, because this is what I knew. You were 13 years old when you saw Pumping Iron for the first time, and you, on PBS, you audio-taped it, and you would listen to the audio-tape at night. I want to hear about that 13-year-old kid going from that to mix. That's the story I want.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, you don't get that story by always interviewing the victor. You need to go to the periphery and do some investigation, observation, and come up with the goods.
Wayne, what do you think about the in-depth reporting? And
I just regret that it's gone, because when I used to be buying the magazines, and I used to read Peter's articles first because I liked the edge that he had in them. He would always have something a little bit controversial. He would say what he thought, and there was no other writer that was quite like that. And then on stage today, there's no real characters anymore, somebody that's a bit different. Perhaps somebody that bends the rules a little bit. Everybody's pretty mundane now and very much the same. And I miss the unique characters that you used to find in the sport a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know the reason for that. Maybe, you know, they'll come in a few years, there'll be a new batch coming of guys who have got this. But, you know, those guys we've mentioned before in the 90s came together at one time and they were all interesting. It'll happen again, but... maybe it's because you might think, say, bodybuilder A, we think, well, he's pretty boring, really. He's got not much. But if you dig, you'll get a story.
Yeah, and you have to dig.
Yeah, you can't spend 5 minutes on it.
Because they all got stories, right?
Yeah,
they all got personalities.
Chris Lund used to say to me, I know your type. I've seen you interview people. You'll sit across the table from them, you're looking at them, and they'll tell you something sensational, and you'll say, hmm. And what they're thinking, oh, that's not sensational, I better come up with something else, you know. Yeah. But part of that was, if I interview somebody for an hour, play the tape back, it'll probably be 55 minutes of them. because that's what it's all about. I've seen, and I'm going off to, I've seen interviewers do things where a guy, oh, well, I don't agree with that. It doesn't matter what you agree with. He's the subject. You're wasting time now.
All right. Now, in this clip, this is an interview I did with Peter McGough and Lonnie Teeper, who used to work for Iron Man Magazine. This was from the podcast on March 25th, 2019. And I sort of forgot about this when I did the interview, but Lonnie and Peter used to actually be rivals back when the magazines were going, because Lonnie worked for Iron Man Magazine and Peter worked for Flex Magazine. So they were on competing magazines. So on this part of the interview, we talk about the shape of bodybuilding and how it's changed from the more aesthetic look to the bigger look. And we also talk about how important posing was. And this is something Peter was very passionate about. So here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And I have two very special guests on the line today, two friends of mine. The first is Lonnie Teeper, and this is Lonnie's first time on the show. And Lonnie is a bodybuilding journalist, has been in the business for many, many years. He worked for Ironman Magazine, and he was an MC with the Arnold Classic and the Pro Ironman Invitational. And my other guest is Peter McGough. And Peter is also a bodybuilding journalist who has been in the business for many, many years. He used to work for Joe Weider's magazine. And then for a time, he worked for Muscle Mag International and also Muscular Development. And today we are going to talk about where bodybuilding is going in the future and where it's been. So welcome to the show, guys. Great to have you both here.
Thank you.
Well, making predictions is always hard, especially when it's about the future.
Right.
I think if we went back 10 years, we had no idea that men's physique or the classic would come in like they did, and the bikini has grown substantially since then. You know, I think we're in a bit of a morass at the moment. I appreciate that maybe they're going to start, you know, with Sean Roden looking for more symmetry conditioning. But the problem is that the guys that have come into the top ranks over the last few years haven't been attaining that look. You know, the Rollies, the big Rammies and everything. But mm-hmm. It's too late for them to turn back. So if we're going to get a change, we're going to have to wait for some new guys coming in who start off with a Sean Roden or a Sean Ray or somebody like that as a physique ideal, not, you know, get as heavy as you can. So it's pretty difficult to say. And the landscape has changed enormously. You know, I think the Olympia is because it's so big, and the Arnold, it's taken away from the bodybuilding. And coupled with the demise of the magazines, we're not able to build stars in the way that we did, you know, put them on covers. It's all right, you know, having your say on social media, but it's not the same as, you know, being in a glossy magazine and your personality being established mm-hmm. by people like Lonnie writing about them and digging in for the stuff. So I think the star power has gone down a little bit and will go down a little bit. You know, I just see that's the way I see it at the moment. It's not sour grapes about the magazine. It's just at this point in time, I see you have to wait for a new batch of guys to get in.
Back and go, those were the days, huh?
Yeah, and I remember Phil Hill, he wasn't really in great shape, but he did that Phantom the Opera routine.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Nobody puts that amount of effort in today. You know, I was on the NPC Council in 2009 when they voted to drop posing as a scoring round. There was only me and a Polish judge argued for it. You know, they felt it was, how can you judge it? I've always had this argument with Bob Ciccarello. It's another way for the judges to look at a physique, see it from different angles. They play to the strengths and everything. If it's not going to be judged, why have the posing routine? We'll just have a straight-through show and we all get home for 6 o'clock in the evening. Yet to me, it's like you don't have the Super Bowl, play the first two halves, and then after halftime come out and the guys run up and down doing drills for 15 minutes. It has no effect on the score. You know, what's the point?
Right.
And that is aligned with, I think, the drop-off in posing. Why do we bother? You know, do we have to catch the eye? We're already been given our placings. Let's save a bit of energy if we make the pose down. And I think that's a lot to do with it. And I talk to so many guys, it's like, why do you pick tunes that nobody knows? You like them. It's some, you know, esoteric artist you like. but you should choose a tune, a dramatic, powerful soundtrack that everybody knows. They come along with it then. They say, in a minute, it's going to go way high, and that's when he's going to hit his best shot. You know, you bring them into it rather than all this clanging, bash, wallop, you know, that's going on with no synchronicity between the music and the poses.
Right.
But, yeah, he was another one who was overlooked, the same sort of Thierry Pastel. I thought that guy was beauty from head to foot.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
He needed to work his arms a little more.
Yeah.
He had about 22-inch arms.
He turned posing in. Even the mandatories were an art form, the transitions as he moved from post to post. It was like ballet. You know, mm-hmm. You never see that now. It's all breathing and spitting. And you know. I always say to guys, look as if you're enjoying it. Even if you think it's tough, smile. The audience wants to see a reaction. Don't make it look hard. I think sometimes some good guys go on there saying, if I make it look hard, they'll think, oh, it must be in shape because he's worked his ass off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you're there to entertain and to get into the audience.
All right, now in this clip, Peter and Lonnie both talk about the classic physique division, which had just been going for a couple of years, and the potential of that to take over open bodybuilding, the men's bodybuilding. And we also, again, talk more about the posing.
Well, talking about that classic division, do you think if they really brought up the posing and they started posing like some of the guys in 88 at that 88 Olympia did, or like Sean Ray did, do you think it would change the popularity of the sport? Do you think the fans would get more behind it?
My opinion, probably not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is what it is. It's, you know, people like, in my experience, in 35 years in the industry, and I don't know how Peter feels, but, you know, they want to see, like, I think Peter called it the circus. You want to see the freak. You want to see something different. These other guys have beautiful physiques, no question about it. But are they something different?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as one guy said, walking out of the Olympia in 1990, I can see these physiques at the neighborhood pool. Now, that's an exaggeration, of course, but I understood what he was trying to say.
Right.
So in classic physique, the problem is you can only be so big. You got the limitations of the weight.
Right.
So, I mean, I hope that it can do that. Don't get me wrong. I'm not against it. I think classic physique, I really admire those physiques. Some great bodybuilders.
Mm-hmm.
Well, bodybuilders, classic physique bodybuilders. But with the size, the limitation on weight, can you really get somebody dominating enough that's going to have this tremendous following? I'm not sure.
Well, I think
you know, take away the freaks at the Olympia, keep every other division at the Olympia, but take out the men's bodybuilding. How many people would be in the seats?
Yeah, but I still think that in the open and the classic anyway. If you're given 3 minutes on stage to pose, why don't you take full advantage of it and try and get the audience stirred up? It'll make a difference, even with the judges. You know, it's like a boxer. You know, he goes to training camp for 3 months. He goes through hell. He drops 20 pounds to get ready. Then he gets into the ring and puts one hand behind his back. Give them all the tools. It might be a pipe dream. All the guys won't do it. But I'm telling you, you know what happened when somebody like a Marcus Haley or Darren Charles, Melvin Anthony, Freddie Smalls comes out. The place goes nuts because the audience is sitting there waiting to be entertained.
Right.
But look at the Arnold Classic. You never hear a bigger roar throughout the whole weekend than when them strongmen come on. People are standing in the aisles. You don't see them doing that with the bodybuilding, and the bodybuilding is supposed to be the main thrill event of the evening.
Yeah. Well, you don't even see anybody posing like Lee Labrati used to pose or Sean Ray used to pose. I mean, Arnold has that new division now for the best poser, and I watched the guy who won. I think it was Joshua Leonardowitz. Nothing against him, but it wasn't that outstanding. It wasn't that great, you know, for a best poser award.
We've had that before. They had that before at the Arnold, the best poser and the most muscular.
Yeah,
and they took
that.
It away. And then they brought it back and they took it away,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I, you know, Peter mentioned Melvin Anthony. He's probably my favorite all-time poser.
Yeah.
But I've had people tell me, what is this guy doing up there dancing? This isn't a strip club. I just want to see posing. This is bodybuilding. Mm-hmm. So even as great as Melvin Anthony was, there were a lot of people that criticized that type of posing, which I love. Because I agree with you guys, we need some type of entertainment. Some effort needs to be put in that posing round, because it is, if it is judged, you got to give it more credence than they do. And if it's not really important, let's don't have it. Like Peter said, we'll be at Morton's at 7 o'clock.
Well, what amazes me is with all the social media out there now, if someone ever did come out and do a kick-ass posing routine, can you imagine how much that would be shared and it would be all over the place because no one else is doing it?
I'll give you an example of this one, John. I put on a show called the NPC West Coast Classic every June here in Riverside. 2 years ago, we had Oksana do a routine, Oksana Grishina, the great fitness champion.
Yep.
Who's just spectacular. And we had three bodybuilders do a skit with her. It was hilarious. I mean, she was phenomenal, but they added some fun to it as well. Dave Lieberman took a cell phone video of that and put it up on social media, and it got, on his cell phone, he got over 100,000 views.
Yeah.
For her, the performance that she did and these guys in the background, over 100,000. So obviously somebody loved it because everybody was going to it and watching it.
My favorite poser is Durham Charles. The reason is he always does something different. You know, the rest of the guys I mentioned, basically it's, you know, a modification of what we've seen before, but he'll come out, he'll do the breakdancing, he'll do, but when he comes out and does that slow motion walk, you know, it's always something different, something creative.
Vince Taylor ranks up there as well, and even Kamali, who wasn't a big fan of mine, I enjoyed his routines.
Yeah.
And Francis Benfatto, I mean, when he was, you were at that Masters, weren't you, Lonnie, in Miami, where he...
Yes, he's phenomenal.
I mean, what was he, 50 then or something?
Not only posing, but Michael Nevue thought Francis Benfatto had the best physique in all of bodybuilding.
Yeah,
he's a little light in the legs, but, you know, I guess Michael didn't really analyze it other than from a photographer's viewpoint, but he said this guy's the best in the whole sport.
Well, he had this...
He thought he should be winning the Olympia every year.
If you take his physique apart, there is discrepancies with symmetry. You know, he's got that short torso, long legs, but it's the spectacular round muscle bellies and the sweep to his, you know, his taper. That, a bit like Arnold, you know, not perfect symmetry, but just these lines that just take your breath away. And
comes all together, yeah.
Yeah.
And Arnold had something, then Francis had it too, but Arnold just had that something, that it factor that John mentioned about Rory. Just when he walked on stage, there was something special. Before he even went into the posing.
Yeah.
You know, certain people just light up a room when they walk in, and Arnold did that, and I think Benfatto did that. We've had others that have done that, but not to the degree of Arnold. You know, we've been waiting for 50 years for the next Arnold. We've had some people that look like him, talk like him, walk like him, but they haven't been the next Arnold, you know, and that's not an easy task to complete.
You mentioned before the it factor. I asked him once, everybody says you've got the it factor. What is the it factor? He says, I don't know, and I don't want to know. I'll just accept it as it is. I don't want to, you know, analyze it to death and then lose it, you know.
Yeah. All right, now on this clip, Lonnie and Peter talk about their rivalry that they had when they were both running competing magazines. So this was pretty interesting. All right, guys.
Anyway.
Well, yeah, I know you got to go, Lonnie. Well, thanks, Lonnie, for coming on the show for the very first time. It was great having you.
Well, thanks for having me. It was an honor being on with Peter McGuff.
Yeah, Peter, thanks for coming on again. I appreciate both of you guys coming on. I definitely appreciate your opinions, and you guys are really experts in the sport. So it's been great having you on, talking about the shape of bodybuilding and where it's going, and hopefully we can have you guys on again.
Yeah, one time maybe. I don't want to push this, but maybe sometime in the future you can have me and Lonnie on again, and we can talk about the gossip wars back in the '80s.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Oh, boy,
me and Laurie were rivals. We weren't, you know.
I could write a book on the troubles that I've had.
That sounds like a great discussion in the future for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I'll end with this one line. You know, Dorian really was upset, like I said before, that I didn't pick him to win that Olympia and my bogus Olympia prediction. So in 95, he was guest posing. I think it was the Nationals. Was it the Nationals, Peter, in Louisiana?
Yeah.
And I brought him to the mic, and he brought it up again. He said, you know, you didn't pick me. You said all these great things about me, but you didn't pick me. And I said, well, I was just trying to be entertaining. And then in the next issue of Flex, Peter wrote about it. He goes, well, why don't you just try to be right? That was funny.
I loved his wit,
you know, even though I was the brunt of that one, you know, I was laughing.
Oh, yeah, Peter's got the lines for sure.
Yeah, you can't beat that British wit, I tell you.
Right.
You know, I'm really from Oklahoma. I'll put this accent on. Get right. Yeah. Everywhere.
Well, you were great in those Naked Gun movies.
If I had a dollar every time somebody had said that.
You know, when did you change your name from Leslie Nielsen? I don't understand this.
Yeah.
He's just jealous of your silver hair, Peter.
I'm jealous of anybody's hair. Especially yours, John.
Yeah, mine's still hanging in there, too.
Can you start thinning a little bit at least?
All right. Now, in this clip, this was an interview I just did with Peter just this year in 2020, or just last year, I should say. I believe it was in March or April. And I was really grateful that Peter took the time out because I know he was probably feeling kind of sick at this point. But he was good enough to do the interview, so I appreciate him doing that. And this was actually our last time we got to talk. So Peter talks about the golden age of bodybuilding and what it was like to have Gold's Gym in its heyday in the 1990s, and also the Weider headquarters where Peter worked. And he also talks a little bit about interviewing the stars of the 1990s, including Kevin Levroni and Flex Wheeler and all the different personalities that were involved. And he talks about some memories he had with Larry Scott and Rich Gaspari. Here we go.
I got along with all of the guys, really. You know, it was a golden time, and it's gone now. You know, that office is no longer there.
I know, I was going to say that.
Gold's Gym is no longer the hallowed ground. I used to go down to Gold's Gym every Friday, and basically I would get my gossip column because everybody was in there. You know, Mike Christian, Chris Coleman was in there. Sean Ray used to come up every now and again, although he was more in Orange County. Larry DeMay was in there, Mike Quinn, Gary Strider, you know, other guys who used to train at Worlds like Lee Priest, Rolf Muller, Bob Paris, you know, they would be at Worlds. But, you know, can you imagine that? You walk into the gym on a Friday morning at the right time,
yeah,
and there's six guys who were top 10 in the Olympia in different parts of the gym, you know, and you, at the time, you didn't realize how golden it was. You know,
yeah,
you couldn't do that now. You know, round up six top guys and take you weeks to get them nailed down now. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I did an interview with Phil Williams, who won the Nationals in 85, and he was talking about when he was training at Gold's during the 80s, and he just said, we always thought it would be like this. You know, we never thought it would ever go away. We never thought it would change.
And, you know, like in 88, when the Olympia was in L.A., and I went there for 10 days before, and, you know, all these top guys were in there. There was Lee Haney and Gaspari, and, you know, all the out-of-towners were already in, you know. Then you'd see some guy and think, my God, he's got a hell of a physique. I've never seen him before. Who is it? You know, you go up and it was Akim Albrecht, who was an amateur. He hadn't won the World Championships then.
Yeah,
I said, so what's your next contest? This was 88. He said, 1990 World Championships. That's the patience he had to wait till then.
Wow.
You know, Aaron Baker was in the gym and nobody really knew Aaron Baker then. It was before he was first. There was other guys in there. There was a guy in there, I can't remember his name and I don't know why. He had the biggest arms, quality arms I've ever seen. He didn't have an awful lot more, but he just disappeared from the scene. You know, we were going to do a shoot with him because it's like his arms are like, I just told you, you know, this guy is. But, you know, I mean, Arnold used to be, he'd be in Worlds, you know, he had his own parking spot.
Yeah.
I mean, now he's sort of seen in Golds a lot, but in those, it was, you know, backing up Joe Gold, he would be in Worlds, you know, it was, you were guaranteed to go any time, and you'd pick some story up, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and then like you had all these great new pros coming up at the same time, and all these guys were at the Olympia. And the thing that was so great about the magazines, I know you and I have discussed this before, was you could have the opportunity to do these long interviews with these guys and have, you know, a 4-page article about their personality. And then we got to know them a lot better. And then we weren't exposed to them on social media every day like we are now. So like you said, we had to wait for that contest to get here. And it really let us know the bodybuilders better, right? And you had guys from all different kinds of personalities, Flex, Lerone. They're all different, distinct personality types.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be when a guy would come on the scene, you know, you think about guys coming on the scene. I mean, Yates was runner-up in his first Olympia in 91. The following year, Levroni in his first Olympia was runner-up. Flex Wheeler, 93. You don't get that today. You don't get a guy winning a national title even qualifying for the bloody Olympics.
Right, right.
But anyway, so... like Levroni comes on the scene, burst on the scene, you know, okay, you do your interview with him, you know, try and suss him out. Now, he was an individual character with quirky ways, amusing ways, and that was the way to paint him, somebody who, you know, you'd start interviewing him and he'd end up interviewing you. So you brought that into his personality, you built it in. You weren't manufacturing anything, but you were building on his strengths. And because it was in the magazine, and, you know, Kevin would then not be able to go on the internet and say something ridiculous to contradict everything we were doing.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, that became this persona, you know, Porter Cottrell, this really nice guy. People used to say, is he really that nice? Nobody can be that nice. I said, is that nice? That is him, you know.
Right.
NASA with his, you know, well, what is wrong with people? Why are they all staring at me? You know, all these things he used to... come out with, you know, and he divorced himself from the main bodybuilders, and, you know, he was one alone. Flex Wheeler, you know, there was a guy, bit temperamental, you know, in those days, totally different guy now, mm-hmm. God bless him. And, you know, I remember interviewing him, and I always know he was putting up a front, and he told me 2 or 3 years ago, he says, you used to sit looking at me, and I'd tell you something, and you wouldn't react. And it was like you were telling me, okay, now tell me what really happened. I'm not buying all the other bullshit, you know.
Right.
And we had a few laughs about it, you know. I mean, Flex was sometimes difficult to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And funnily enough, 3 or 4 years after he finished, he came to me and apologized for all the hard times, you know, in terms of not turning up for photo shoots or being late or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, he realized it was, and he was genuine. There was nothing for him to gain. He couldn't get a contract or anything.
Right.
He just came to the realization. I mean, he is such a, you know, a change in his personality from,
yeah.
I think he was shy, introvert in a way. And so he had to act as if he was an extrovert, and it didn't come naturally to him.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I agree.
And now he's sort of secure in his own being now, you know. It's funny how these guys all develop, you know, and you're talking about, you know, like Lee Haney just celebrated his 60th birthday, you know, and you remember him as a 23-year-old, you know, Kasmari. You know, the first time I met him, he admits it. He says, I was just a punk, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a coffee, New Jersey, you know. He was, the first time I met him was I'd seen him in the Olympia, 85. He did a tour of England after the Olympia. He was third in the Olympia. That was his first Olympia. He was third. Beckles was second, Haney was first.
Right.
Did a tour of England, and again, I did my thing. I need to get him, you know, do a photo shoot, but he was not doing photo shoots, not doing interviews. Then he wanted a lift to this seminar place, so me and the photographer, Jeff Collins, gave him a lift. Jeff Collins is driving with, you know, with Gaspari in the front. And Jeff starts talking to him, you know, and so, you know, as you get into this body, what sort of turns you on? And he's talking away, and he said, you know, one inspiration was... some guy, I can't remember his name now,
he was like £400, and he got down to £200 to win the universe. I can't remember his name. Oh. And I said, Bruce Randall, you know. Oh. And he looked down as like, oh, and this has happened before. If you drop something in early to somebody, they realize, oh, he knows a little bit.
Right.
And he looked at me like, you're not as dumb as you look. And then he changed his mind, and we did the photo shoot and the interview, because it wasn't just somebody who, you know, some freelancer from nowhere who was trying to get a story, you know.
Yeah. I did an interview with Kasparia a couple of years ago, and he told the same story, and he called him Tony Randall.
Yeah, he had a hell of a scene, didn't he? Jack Klugman beat him in the absinthe iceberg. I mean, I think back, you know, and it's like, I keep using the phrase coming up. I've interviewed every Mr. Olympia apart from Sean Roden, you know, and I never got the chance to do that, you know, given the timing and everything, you know. But, you know, there's a story with all of them. You know, Larry Scott, I interviewed him 95 about his Olympia experiences, and then now and again we do like a round robin thing, you know, ask so and so five bodybuilders about this aspect, you know.
Yeah, I remember that.
I'm not sure we built up a relationship. I wasn't even sure that he knew who I was. But at the 2011 Masters in Florida, were you there?
No, I missed that.
Well, he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award, and the night before we had a press conference, and they announced that Larry would get the Lifetime Achievement Award, and asked him to say a few words. Now, this is one of the biggest shocks I've ever had. He stood up. He says, before I start, I'd like to give thanks to a guy who's done so much for bodybuilding. And he looked across at me, and I thought, he's not talking about me, because he doesn't know me, you know. He says, there's an English guy who came here and really, you know, did great things, wrote great things, and I'd just like to walk across and shake his hand. And he did that. He shook my hand, and I was speechless.
Wow.
And some guy said to me afterwards, but you never responded, you know, apart from that. I says, I couldn't. I was too emotional. Larry Scott comes up to you and tells you, you know, is this a dream? He used to come into the office maybe twice a year, even though he lived in Utah, because he used to advertise in the magazine. So he'd come in with new artwork or whatever. So he'd say hello, but I never realized he even knew who I was, you know. But that was one of the, looking back, you know, certainly one of the most surprising moments, one of the most, you know, grateful moments that somebody, I mean, he's a legend, you know.
Yeah.
First Mr. Olympia.
Larry just seemed like just such a genuinely nice guy. I remember when I was a kid and I used to read Muscle Builder, and he had the Ask Larry column in the back. And you could just tell by the way he answered a question. He was like, he seemed really concerned and wanted to help everybody that wrote a question to him. He just seemed like such a nice person.
I remember the first time Sean Perrine, you know, the late Sean Perrine, introduced himself to Larry. It was Olympia Expo, and he contacted Larry because Sean was put in charge of collecting all the Mr. Olympias that were at that contest and get them on stage. Okay. It wasn't the big one when everybody was there. This was a few of them missing.
Right.
And he says, I always remember because I was there with Sean. And Larry says, and your name is? And Sean says, Sean Perrine. And Larry said, what's a lovely name. it was, I don't know why he said it, but, you know, that was,
yeah.
You know, it sort of stuck in my memory that he had that, you know.
It's a shame that the younger people today don't remember the impact Larry had, because I interviewed Roy Callender. And Roy was the 79 Canada Cup or something like Diamond Cup. And that was the last time he made his comeback in.
Yeah.
When he was talking about that, he said Larry was in the show. And I said, oh, I forgot about that. And Roy said, I didn't forget about it. He said, that was like one of the greatest moments of my life. And he goes, I went up to him backstage, and I told him what an honor it was to be on stage with him, because Roy remembered what an impact the impact Larry made back in the 60s, you know.
Yeah, it's funny when I, you know, when I got into looking at magazines in the 60s, this was even before Arnold and all those guys came in. You know, the real stars were Larry Scott, Reg Park, Dave Draper, Freddie Ortiz, you know. And I don't know why it is, I can't explain it. But because I was part of the sport when the other guys started to come through, I had no inhibitions about talking to Franco or Zane or, you know. But I was always in awe of Larry and Dave Draper and Reg Park. I never met Freddie Ortiz. I met the other three. And I remember Dave Draper came into the office, and then somebody came down to my office and said, Dave's outside, you know, I'd like to see you. And I thought, Dave Draper. I did tell his wife, Laurie, I don't know why it is, Reg Park, Dave, you know, Larry. They were still these images, these long ago images in the magazine, like gods, you know, whereas the other guys, I've seen them come through. So they didn't suddenly hit me as, wow, what's that? You know, the first time you saw Scott, he was complete, you know.
Yeah. They must be the ones we grow up idolizing when we're kids, and we never lose that idolization, right?
Yeah. It was, and, you know, Larry had that personality that carried everything off, you know. A very straightforward, down-to-earth guy. I mean, most of them were. There's very, you know, I mean, I'm often told, asked, who are the biggest arseholes of a man bodybuilding? And I have to think, you know, I mean, other people have got their own views.
All right, now in this clip from our interview with Peter that I did in 2020, Peter talks about how he used to be like an investigative reporter when he would cover these contests, and how he would go together about putting the contest reports together for the magazines. And he also talks a little bit about some breaking stories that he was involved with, including the one with Craig Titus and Kelly Ryan, and also the Ray McNeil shooting. It was such a different time. Like, you're right now. Like, now, you not only get the results right away, you see the show live, and then it's over by Monday. By Monday, it's like, well, who's going to win next year? It's like...
Yeah. And you think, you know, you follow the play-by-plays, and, you know, which are well done for the most part. And then the after interviews, you don't learn a lot with interviewing a guy when he's just won. He can't even take it in. The time to do it is the next morning and then do an article on him. But that's gone now. So you tend to think, oh, that's how so-and-so responded to winning this contest. I know the whole story now. Well, it's like, I mean, my job was to, as a writer, I used to try and take the fans into places that they couldn't get to. You know, I wouldn't discuss who had the best back double biceps. They can make their own mind up based on the photographs. But who was in a bad mood? Who was in a good mood? Who was joking? Who was doing this? Who was really? Who was being sick? You know, who was, you know, the whole thing. And build a story, a narrative, you know, not just a succession of, you know, paragraphs, but get a theme running through it and knit it into a, you know, a flowing story with a beginning, middle, and an end, you know. I think if today, see what used to happen, this was even pre-top laptops and everything. So Saturday night, the Olympia would take place. You would dash around getting some interviews afterwards with guys, you know, you'd hold him there, I'm coming, you know, you had to get organized because they were all trying to rush off, especially if they didn't do very well. So you'd end up with all your notes from the day, the prejudging, all the quotes afterwards. There was no internet, so at least you'd go out and have a meal after it was all over. You'd get on the plane Sunday, you'd try and do something handwritten. Then what I used to do is I'd stay at home Monday. I'd write the whole report, stay up usually Monday night, go in Tuesday morning, give them the report, and then they would start work on it. The photographs would probably arrive late Tuesday or Wednesday, and it was filmed. There was no digital.
Right.
So I had to write a report totally based on what I saw and remembered. Later on, you could have a look at the digital. Well, maybe his biceps weren't that good, you know. But you were committed to write it that way. And that's how it all used to come together, you know. It would take days to do it. But I still wonder if somebody, say the next Olympia or even the last Olympia or every Olympia, if somebody said, we'd like to come out with a report, you know, on the Wednesday, the real story behind the Olympia, and do it in that way. Because I'd do the main report, then there'd be two or three other guys who'd be following up, get Labrada's take on this, get so-and-so, they do a sidebar, you know, on what.
Yeah.
And if something happened, you'd get the whole Olympia package, you know, the whole story from start to finish in one stop, you know. I just wonder whether people, I'm sure some people would still have the stamina to go through that on a Wednesday and find out they'd learnt an awful lot of things that they didn't learn on the Saturday, Sunday, Monday.
Right, now. Right. Well, you were there at a time when you were really like a newspaper reporter. You were like an investigative reporter, right?
Yeah. Funnily enough, nowhere was that better exemplified than when Sally McNeill murdered Ray McNeill, her husband, in 1995. It was St. Valentine's Day. So I got into the office, I think it was a Tuesday, suddenly heard about, because things didn't spread then. I think Steve Ennistrom told me, because he was in San Diego where they were, you know, Oceanside. And Julian Schmidt sat behind me. John Little sat somewhere else. I said, I need your phones. You two are going to have to find somewhere else to work, because I got a direct line through to the DA, because he wants a lot of information on Ray. I gave him his bio and his book, you know. The local paper, I got onto them. I gave them photographs so they could show Ray. They gave me information. And I came out with a scoop of actually what went on. And, of course, it was still 6 weeks before anybody read it, you know. And I was really on the job, you know. Felt like, you know, was it Jimmy Olsen, you know, cub reporter. You know. Fast forward to 2005. Leaving home on Friday, it was the Craig Titus and Kelly Ryan case. They were on the lam then. I'd connected with the district attorney. He phoned me like I was just about ready to leave work from Vegas, you know. He phoned me from Vegas and said, we're about to pick them up in Boston. We tracked them down to a hairstylist or something like that. And she got him. So he tipped me off and I went, oh, my God, it's 6:30 on a Friday. And now I've got, you know, the cub reporter had disappeared. Now it was like, do I really have to go through all
that? Right.
Obviously we did it. Because then it was no sort of, well, this can wait till Monday. That had to be out there that night because we had the exclusive, could tip everybody off what was happening, you know.
Right, right.
You know, the gossip column I did, Hard Times, I used to pour everything into it, you know, very competitive, you know, in terms of having not just get the scoop, but put in a spin on it and adding some humour to it and connecting it with something else, mm-hmm. you know. I used to collect all this information over the month and then, like, 2 or 3 days before the deadline, I would go home with all this information and put the column together. No, that's not worthy. That's no, this needs to be added, you know. And I used to pick all the photographs and everything, so it was like a little newspaper, you know, of its own. It was like a mini pumping press, because, which is the tabloid we used to do, because we used to have headlines on the first page of the gossip column. What Samia said next, so-and-so in fist fight, you know, whatever. You know,
right.
Shouting Bruno as you've never seen him before, whatever. You know,
right.
It was like the headlines. You know?
All right, and now I want to end with this final clip. This was from the time I interviewed Peter with Wayne Glash, and Peter told me before the interview started, he said, if you want to ask me about, you know, what I'm going through with this cancer, he said, I'm okay with talking about it. I said, okay.
So when we got to the last part of our interview, when we were just wrapping it up, I asked Peter to talk about it, and I thought this would be a good place to finish off our tribute to the great and late Peter McGough.
Peter, tell us how you're doing, too, because I know you don't mind talking about this if you were asked. How you feeling lately? I know you have a lot of fans out there and a lot of people, which I think is great that a lot of people still care about you and they're thinking about you.
Yeah, I mean, to all the fans out there, to both of you.
Coach Ritter.
I'm doing okay at the moment. I had a bit rough last year, but I just want to say that I could never have got through this without my wife, Anne, and other people. But it's not about me. I mean, I've been going through this for 5 years now. I never thought I would go through this. All I can tell you is that when you're told you've got cancer, you know, your head goes haywire. You don't know what to think. How can you fight this? I settled down and said, okay, I'm not going to look back what caused it. I'm not going to look too far forward. I'm not going to Google my diagnosis because that will send you crazy.
Yeah.
I'm going to take it an appointment, a procedure, a month at a time. A bit like bodybuilding. Short-term goals, long-term ones. And I know people say it really counts to be positive, but it really does. As long as you're not conning yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can honestly say that in 5 years, I've never had a moment of depression.
Wow.
Or woe me. I tend to look at it another way, like, well, I am 68. I've had a crack at life. I see a lot of people in the clinic I go to, a lot younger than me, who aren't going to make it. Yeah. And I'm thinking they haven't had a proper shot. You know, at least I got to where I wanted to get to. So I don't feel sorry for myself. And I want people out there to know that it's hard for the guy who's got cancer. It's hard for the family. It's hard for the friends. Just stay in there. Stay positive. Keep going. Because there's always new things coming up,
yeah.
New procedures. It's your job to keep alive for the next year till the next procedure comes up. And that's the way I go. And it's like I always think of a saying by Winston Churchill. If you're going through hell, keep going.
Yeah.
You have no choice.
Get through it.
Yeah. You have to get through it. So I don't want anybody to feel sorry for me. I just want people to know it's not a death sentence particularly.
Yeah.
That you can get through it and there's new advances coming through all the time. And with me, I had to figure out, I obviously want to live. Why do I want to live? Certain reasons. What's the most important? Fix. American bodybuilding, got this one long-term goal, not seven, one long-term goal. What's your long-term goal? The sole thing that's going to keep you going. I will not leave my wife, Anne, on her own. I keep saying to her, I ain't going anywhere. I cannot bear the thought, not that I'm a great person, of her being on her own. So I'm not going to let it happen.
Hmm.
Not for a while, anyway. And that's what I say, just keep going. Take it a week at a time. There are rough times, there's lots of pain, there's lots of not nice things happen, but there's always tomorrow and next week. You'll get through it. Just grit your teeth and get through it.
Great. Well, we're all praying for you.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring another episode of the podcast. And thank you again to all our Patreon donors who are generously donating money each month to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast to help us keep going. If you're interested in being a Patreon donor, you can just go to bodybuildinglegendshow.com, which is the official website. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the link for the Patreon donors. All right, before we go, I want to read this article from, I'm not sure what issue of Iron Man this was, but it was in 1980. It was written by our friend Roger Schwab. And Roger, of course, was one of the head judges of the professional IFBB during the late 70s, early 80s. And he wrote some great articles for Iron Man that I used to read when I was coming up in the sport when I was a teenager. So thanks again to Pat Comer for sending these articles here. So since we are talking about the year 1980 in our discussion last week with Jerry Branum, and we're also going to be doing it next week, I thought it would be timely to read this article. So it's called The Night of the Champions, the Final Grand Prix. It says, anyone attending the 1980 Night of the Champions in New York, anticipating merely a tune-up for the Mr. Olympia, was in for a shock. The Night of the Champions this year was a finale in itself. Pure competition, peak condition, and only win attitudes.
16 professional IFBB champions had laid it on the line for this one. The Night of the Champions 3, while not in the epitome of King Olympia, had certainly come of age as a crown prince. While Mensur and Padilla and Zane would wait out the fall in Melbourne, everyone else laying potential claim to the throne was here, in spades. It's imperative to mention that the judges and contestants met head-to-head before the actual competition to review the basic IFBB constitution and ground rules. Judging procedures were spelled out clearly. A perfect score of 20 points in a round would be totally deserved. There would be no overall perfect score of 300 at the end of this evening. As it turned out, 20s were few and far between, hard to come by, as it should be, as it must be. Let us review now the competition itself, dwelling primarily on the front runners, those who came for one reason only, to win. The competition itself started strong in the presence of Casey Viator. Casey had entered the four previous Grand Prix contests of 1980, winning two of them. Tonight, his final leg of the tour weighed heavily upon him. The density of muscle and the long, large muscle bellies were evident, yet they gave way to an overtrained, tired look, not dissimilar to Mike Mensur's condition at this same show last year. Constant training, dieting, and the stress that encompasses the bodybuilding circuit had dug inroads even into this genetic giant, and he knew it. Yet he was there. Even an overtrained, overcontested Viator can stand on the stage with anyone, though not in the potential unbeatable condition possible. Casey would be competitive right into the finals. What a welcome sight Harold Poole was, not far from those glory years in the 60s, especially 1963 when he was Mr. America to everyone in Harris, Pennsylvania, except the seven men who stood in judgment on that famous evening. Though not quite the young giant who created the most muscular pose, Poole, while maybe out-muscled this night, was definitely not outclassed. With continued training and insight, Poole could be where he was 20 years ago, maybe better. Chris Dickerson was looking for his third Grand Prix win this year, he and Viator having split the first four decisions in Florida at the first stop this year. Chris was nearly flawless, at the limits of his potential. It was good enough to win in Florida. Tonight, while slightly smaller and like Viator, appearing weary at the end of the contest road, Chris still had the look of a winner. His stage presence from relaxed stance to mandatory posing is totally complete with no flaws. Exact precision attained from utmost concentration. His posing routine delivered to I Know I'll Never Fall in Love Again must place him just behind Corny and way above the rest of the pack. Dickerson's physique presents a graceful, pleasing picture difficult to dislike. Boyer Coe was better than any previous contest he has entered this year, yet still a stone's throw away from where he'll be at Olympia time. Boyer seems to improve slightly at each event and then suddenly takes a giant step at each Olympia. If the past 2 years are any indication, Coe will be exceptional at Melbourne. Let only the foolish discount him then. Roy Callender, this night at least, is the largest muscular contestant. The slabs of pectoral, delt, and quadricep muscle has no equal. Callender will be right in there down to the wire. When all the fine points are ironed out, if he can be done, Roy will stand alone, for his mass and muscular potential may outweigh even Viator, Mensur, Fox, and Robinson. Annabelle Lopez, while vastly improved over his earlier appearances this year, still senses that audience at the pro shows want more from him, either more muscle or razor-sharp muscularity. His potential is the latter, in which condition he is brilliant. Not tonight. Tom Platz was not near top muscular condition tonight. Much too big, much too smooth. I'll leave any advice to those who know him well enough to give him an honest critical appraisal. A sincere hint may be far fewer calories and shorter, totally intense training. Bill Grant can be counted on to be in shape, and he certainly was tonight. No negative vibes from the crowd, just good feelings back and forth with opposing routine set to disco, which is totally creative. Bill feels good about himself, and it is contagious. Mohamed Makaway, for the first time in a year, approaches the splendid condition that he achieved in late 1976 and 1977. Although not quite as sharp, he is doing something very right and was in it tonight all the way. The future for McAway's competition, watch out. Ed Corny, definitely the highlight of the entire contest for me. Corny was in finer contest shape than anyone on this night, bar none. Gone was the bloat around the obliques, lower back, and abdominals. Intense vascularity and lean muscularity were in its place. At the 1977 Olympia, Corny neared his potential. Tonight, he was even closer. 2 years of still the best poser and his last contest humbled silently before Ed Corny this night. At age 45, he is just beginning. Tommy Abar, though a fine physique, is just not ready for this competition, period. Steve Mihalik displays hard muscularity and actually great muscle size for the very small joints he possesses. Along with specific neck specialization, Steve looks as if he might benefit from a short, high-intensity training routine. I have seen Tony Emmett in far more muscular shape. Still, he is and always will be a class physique that is just totally pleasant to watch. Samir Banute was heavier and less impressive than at his Universe win last year, and he knew it. No finer lines exist on any physique. Whether he retains water or he carries excess fat, it is standing in his way in his quest to the top. Carlos Rodriguez has been in shape at every event this year. He needs total refinement in every phase of his presentation to compete with the best, and he does just that. Robbie Robinson was, in a word, terrific. If Columbus had been his nadir, New York has been his apex. Just a shade off as his sharpest muscularity, Robbie looks far better than last year's Olympia. Melbourne may be just the climate he is looking for in 1980. And then going round by round, in round one, standing relaxed, the first impressions were Callender, Robinson, Dickerson, Corny, and Viator would all be there. Callender, Dickerson, and Robinson at the end of the round were tied with 96, followed by Viator with 95 and Corny with 94. Round two, mandatory posing. The highest score in round two was recorded by Callender with a 98. Robinson and Dickerson were consistent with 96s. Casey had 95 and Corny again 94. So after two rounds, it was Callender with 194, Dickerson and Robinson 192, Viator 190, and Corny 188. Round three, free posing. The evening portion of the contest, the free posing, always brings out the highest scores. The reason seems to be twofold. One, the judges may be somewhat intimidated by the audience reaction. And two, hopefully, because the contestants' free posing to their own music is a creative expression of their physique, leading to perfection in scoring. Corny was perfection in his presentation, likewise Dickerson, and perfect 100s were registered by both. Robbie followed with a 98, Callender 96, and Casey 95. So prior to the posedown of the final five, the scoring was Dickerson 292, Robinson and Callender 290, Corny 288, and Viator 285. Pose down. The highly competitive pose down determined the outcome. Dickerson, although receiving only two first place votes, which are added to the first three rounds, was the winner with 294 overall points. Robbie won three additional votes to give him a 293 total, and Callender received one vote for 291. My vote went to Ed Corny, who finished fourth with 289 points. Casey finished fifth, scoring no points in the pose down to finish with 285 points. Any of the top five could have won, and all had their fans in the audience. Apart from the competition, I would be amiss not to mention the guest posing routine of The Physiques, the largest women's bodybuilding club in the United States. 16 of the club's muscular and graceful women posing to the rhythm of jazz. Their performance was well received. Excellent. The dual posing routine of Boyer and Valerie Coe was likewise creative and inspiring. Two fresh original interludes topping off a highly competitive physique contest. Wow, that was great. Great stuff from the 1980 Night of the Champions. I forgot a lot of that. I also forgot about Ed Corny being in such great shape in that contest. I remember seeing pictures from that, but I totally forgot about that. And, of course, Roy Callender was in great shape. And it's interesting to note that this was probably about 5 months before the Mr. Olympia, 4 or 5 months before the Mr. Olympia. And, of course, nobody knew Arnold was going in it, but it looked like it was going to be between Dickerson. And, unfortunately, Robbie did not do the Olympia that year, which he was really missed. And then Menser, as they said, he sat out. Of course, Zane sat out this contest. And Boyer, as he always did, reached his peak at the Mr. Olympia. So that was very, very interesting. So thanks to Pat Cormer for sending us that. And next week, after we do our interview with Jerry Branum, where we talk about the other contests from 1980, I'm going to read another article about the 1980 Night of the Champions that was also featured in that same issue of Iron Man magazine. All right, that is it for our episode this week. rest in peace, Peter McGough. We will miss you. He was a good friend of mine, and he was a great historian and a person who I really love talking to about the history of bodybuilding. So it's a shame he's gone, but he fought a valiant fight against cancer for so many years, almost 10 years of fighting. So all the best to his wife, Anne. I know she's going through some tough times right now because that was her life partner for all those years. So I hope she's doing okay and is relying on her friends and family to get through this. And hopefully she'll listen to this episode. It'll give her a little bit of comfort as well. All right, so that's it for this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. We'll be back next week with Jerry Brainham, where we will talk about the year 1980. Take care.